1, 2, 3.
Welcome to In the Studio, a 21st century perspective on history's greatest rock bands. I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, it's the 50-year franchise of Jethro Tull.
Unfortunately, my underpants were a bit tight, and when I used to hit the high notes on the flute, it used to cause an involuntary upward movement of the left leg in reaction to the intense pain around the groin area, so I think it must have been something to do with that.
Skating away, skating away, skating away, on the thin eyes of the new day. Let's bungle in the jungle. Well, that's all right by me. Yes.
I mean, when Green Day came along, my eyes were popping out of my head as much as the lead singers were, because I thought, hey, I do that. That's my trick.
Oh, be forgiven. Let's go.
Hello, this is Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull in the studio.
In 1971 and 72, there was no more exciting, unique, and successful band in the world than Jethro Tull. With back-to-back albums Aqualung and the number one worldwide seller Thick as a Brick, both of which were devoted full episodes in the past here in the studio, Jethro Tull combined hard rock, pastoral acoustic instruments, progressive rock arrangements, and dense, thought-provoking lyrics into a heady brew that had really no comparison. But how did they get there? And after soaring number one in their native UK as well as the US with Thick as a Brick, an album containing a single 44-minute long song, what could they possibly do next? Originating in the northern English town of Blackpool, Jethro Tull was a name borrowed from the inventor of the seed drill. By 1968, they were as talked about as any band on the London club scene, primarily because their lead singer, Ian Anderson, whose leaping, scowling, Mad Hatter stage theatrics made for a great show. And there was another thing. Anderson's choice of musical instrument was unconventional for a rock band.
Flute began really its outing just as Jethro Tull got formed, and I think I probably only played a couple of pieces on stage with it, but the audience picked up on it, probably because it was different, and it became more noticeably as I added more songs that I could play on the flute to the things we played. The audience began to become more interested in that, and there was a time when Chris Wright, who was one of the two managers of the group, had to come and have a quiet word with me to suggest respectfully that perhaps I should give up playing the flute because it wasn't really a suitable instrument for a blues band, and maybe it would be better if I stood at the back of the stage and learned to play a little bit of rhythm piano. Obviously, I cheerfully ignored those comments and carried on with what I was doing, which is just as well. But at least we had something going which made us a little bit different. And we also had an irreverent approach towards the blues, a sort of cheerful and slightly flippant approach. We didn't take it too seriously. We were more interested in developing from the strict purist blues into something that was a bit more fun and a bit more adventurous harmonically and rhythmically than the things that everybody else was doing. And doing, I hasten to add, much better than we were. So, we adopted a slightly different approach, I think.
You hear me calling in your sweet dream. Going back to be all the things you want to be. While in sweet dreams you softly sigh. You hear my voice is calling to be mine again. Live the rest of your life in a day.
To go with Jethro Tull's flute-punctuated sound was Ian Anderson's on-stage theatrics. None more memorable than his pose as a one-legged flamingo.
When I was very young, I mean, in my teens, I was very, very slim. I mean, dare I say skinny, sort of 28-inch waist or something, and, you know, weighed about 130 pounds or something. And so, I mean, I wore a pretty small size in clothing, but as I became in a position through some slight income from playing concerts to actually afford to eat, I got a little bit bigger and went up to a size 30 waist, and the underwear also, you know, needed to go along with it. But unfortunately, my underpants were a bit tight, and when I used to hit the high notes on the flute, it used to cause an involuntary upward movement of the left leg in reaction to the intense pain around the groin area. So I think it must have been something to do with that. That's the flippin' dancer. Other than that, I can't really tell you. It's just something that kind of happened and people picked up. I really wasn't aware that I did it. It was just the press started writing about it, and then I got very embarrassed that they started using all this sort of one-legged flamingo-type sort of adjectival abuse. So I stopped doing it for a while. I made sure that I didn't do it for a bit, but then it just started happening again. It's just one of those kind of things that people do. I mean, it wasn't a choreographed movement, just something that happened. And I mean, I do it now in the sense of being aware that people, in a sense, expect that, you know, in a slight tongue-in-cheek way. I mean, I still adopt that pose for them and, you know, give them a chance to try out their new cameras.
Thank you.
Jethro Tull's 1969 second album, Stand Up, actually went to number one in England, but barely even charted in America. Early on, Ian Anderson and his Blackpool schoolmates experimented with many musical styles, just trying to get a paying gig.
Well, we did actually attempt to take the blues stuff through the circuit of clubs that existed, but we really didn't get very far. Particularly once we got outside the local pubs and youth clubs around Blackpool, where the novelty of being a blues group was, we're only playing maybe to 20 or 30 people a night, but we had a little coterie of fans that were following us around even then. But once we set off into the real world, as it were, to places like Bolton and Manchester and Macclesfield and Burnley and Bradford and places around the north of England, soul music ruled the day, and everybody was doing covers of Sam and Dave and such like, and Otis Redding and that sort of stuff. So in order to get any gigs at all, you know, we had to do some of that, which, I mean, was just, none of us could play. I certainly couldn't sing. And in order to give it some credibility, we enrolled a couple of saxophone players into the band to give it some semblance of being a kind of R&B stroke soul group. But as soon as we went down to London, then we reverted instantly to being a blues band again. Although we were being still sold as a seven-piece, only four of us turned up. Well, we used to just say that, you know, they were stuck on the motorway somewhere, or they'd been in a car accident or something, you know. Never mind, they weren't very good anyway, we used to say. So the then four-piece Jethro Tull, well, in fact, it was the four-piece John Evans Band at the time, before it was actually called Jethro Tull, was hawked around the clubs and as a four-piece until we got sufficiently noticed and rebooked, by which time we were called, amongst many other names, Jethro Tull. So that was the name we had to stick with and live with at the point where we became sufficiently adept at what we were doing to be asked back.
Jethro Tull's co-manager at the time, Terry Ellis, liked the hippie ethos of the Benefit concert and proposed Benefit as the album's name.
I think he got it from that idea and wanted to call it Benefit because it seemed, you know, like a sort of generous and sort of groovy kind of title for something that seemed to suggest it was going to be free, which was the vogue of the day. Mind you, the standard of equipment I was talking about, it should have been free. But no, we did actually get paid for it, and we got paid for the record as well. But I never liked the title because it seemed to me a sort of a rather strange one. Also, the album cover was of his making as well, the sort of stand-up, the little sort of stick-on figures on a kind of cardboard stage. And I remember, I don't know if you've seen the Spinal Tap movie, but it was a bit, when we actually saw, how it was described to us being this wonderful sort of, wonderful cover, you know, that had been designed, and it was supposed to be like a very elaborate toy theatre stage. And when we actually saw it, we looked at it in the same way as the members of Spinal Tap looked at each other when they saw the stage set for Stonehenge. So it was a bit, we thought, whoops, you know, oh dear. But it was too late because we were such a rush to get the record out, we had to go with it. And it was a pretty, you know, looking back on it today, it's not one of our best album covers. And it, I think it was actually after that that I think I got determined that album covers better come within the role of my at least overseeing in terms of content, and I felt they got a bit better after that.
Well, the dawn was coming, heard him ringing on my bed. He said, my name's a teacher, oh, that is what I call myself. But I must insist it's true. Jump up.
Teacher from Jethro Tull's 1973 album Benefit reached number 3 in the UK, but even more importantly, rose to number 11 in the States, undoubtedly due to Ian Anderson's songwriting combined with the muscular guitar work of Martin Barr. Ian recalls how Martin Barr joined Jethro Tull.
Unfortunately, his amplifier didn't work, and so he was unable to play at the audition. So we didn't really hear anything at all, and so he was dispatched with the others, but we decided we didn't really like the other people who turned up for the audition, so not having actually heard Martin, I asked him to come back and try again. The second time he turned up, he just arrived at my, I can't call it a house, it was actually a one-room sort of cold water apartment in the north of London, and only this time he arrived without an amplifier at all. And with an electric guitar, so the only way I could hear what he was playing is to hold the end of his guitar against my head, you know, to actually hear it resonating that way to see whether he could play or not. So that we, but it was his breathing, because he was pretty nervous, was actually louder than what he was playing. So we still weren't sure. I think we were probably about halfway through the American tour before we actually heard him.
Some
Well, I think what happened was that we'd taken, there were some things on the Stand Up album which were riff-oriented, things like A New Day Yesterday, which had sort of prominent, you know, big-sounding guitar riffs, and we, having spent a year playing around America, I think that kind of approach had become distilled into a sort of riff-rock kind of feel, and I think we just took that further on the Benefit album into... doing a number of songs that employed fairly prominent guitar riffs.
Up next, Ian Anderson reveals his inspiration for the game changer Aqualung. I'm Red Beard. You're in the studio with Ian Anderson for part one of 5450.
Hi, welcome back to In the Studio. I'm Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull, and you're listening to me and Redbeard.
Thanks, Ian. This is part one of In the Studio's Best of Jethro Tull on their remarkable 50th anniversary. The success of the album Stand Up and Benefit in the UK allowed Jethro Tull to venture in a limited way to play opening support gigs in America in 1969 and 1970, and that experience influenced what would become the fourth Jethro Tull album, Aqualung, in 1971, according to Ian Anderson with me in the studio.
A lot of English bands who went away and played in America came back wearing cowboy hats and fringe jackets and starting to write songs about, you know, grooving in good old LA and whatever, you know, started to try and pretend to be American, you know, because they were very impressed and infatuated with all of that. And for us, it was the opposite. I mean, I wanted to come back and do something that was much more British and was much more truly about me and where I was from. So it was an album that consisted of a lot of songs which were to do with things that I had felt and gone through in my sort of years of puberty, basically. I mean, sort of, you know, that kind of, you know, from 12 through till about 16, 17 years old, that sort of era when I was, you know, kind of testing authority a bit and going through a lot of, you know, fairly sort of, I suppose, typically youthful, aggressive standpoints towards a lot of things, particularly sort of questioning, obviously, the role of religion, which I find myself questioning even now. You've got to look, usually a very short distance from your own shores, to see where religious wars or opposing religions' activities result in war. You know, it's just happening all over the place, isn't it? You know, under this guise of sort of, you know, religion, fervor, sort of identity and all the rest of it. What is it all about? You know, can't we just have a God that was like the one we were brought up to believe in? You know, it's got a nice white beard and, you know, sits back and smokes a Peterson pipe and pats little girls on the head, a kind of Santa Claus, a sort of Father Christmas kind of God. You know, he was fairly safe. What we end up with is this kind of, you know, a different God for virtually every religion, you know, and this terrible, terrible sense of it being an excuse for people's innate desire to wreak havoc with each other, you know. It's just horrific.
Sitting on the park bench, eyeing little girls with bad intent. Snot running down his nose. In the cold sun, watching as the pretty panties run. Hey, Aqualung, feeling like a dead duck, spitting out pieces of his broken lung. Oh, Aqualung, sun streaking cold. An old man wandering lonely, taking time the only way he knows. There couldn't bat as it bends to pick a dark end. It goes down to the park and warns.
Aqualung, my friend, don't you start away uneasy. You poor old sod, you see it's only me.
Sitting on the park bench, eyeing little girls with bad intent. Snot running down his nose, greasy fingers smearing shabby clothes. Hey, Aqualung, drying in the
So, I mean, the crazy thing about writing an album like Aqualung is that a lot of these things I wrote about, which were actually, you know, writing about what I felt when I was 15 or 16, I don't feel that different now. I mean, not a lot has changed, you know.
Doesn't
in terms of the way I feel about
you now?
It.
When you were 15 or 16, didn't you think that all of this would be revealed when you got
yeah,
to be an adult?
That's exactly right, which is why I think I felt if I didn't write that stuff then, I might change my viewpoint as I got older. I might, you know, and I'd better sort of, you know, capture these sort of fairly, you know, sort of fiery and rather naive views at the time and commit them in some way in a song, because if I didn't do it then I might change my mind. As it happens, I think most of the things that I wrote about there, I mean, although they may be simplistic and naive, the essence of them is pretty much how I feel about things now. I really don't feel any different.
When more than one rock critic in 1971 declared that Jethro Tull's international hit album Aqualung was a concept album, bandleader and songwriter Ian Anderson, then the 24-year-old singer and famously one-legged flute player of Jethro Tull, set out purposely to confound those pundits with the band's next album in April 1972, entitled Thick as a Brick, containing simply one song. One 43-minute-long song. Here's the musical mason behind the original Thick as a Brick, Ian Anderson, with me in the studio.
Aqualung was a reflection of my puberty sort of years as regards my views about religion, my attitude towards relationships. It was a kind of, you know, I was writing those songs very much from the point of view of being a 14, 15-year-old. However, Thick as a Brick, in trying to make that come alive, I decided that I should really try and present this music in a humorous way. And the saving grace of Thick as a Brick is that that sense of humor does stay sufficiently close to the surface that you don't get pissed off with the album for being too arty, too clever, too bombastic. Or at least hopefully you don't. If you moderately like Jethro Tull and Thick as a Brick is okay, because that sense of humour is always there. It's there in the album cover. It's in all the artwork, the spoof newspaper and all the rest of it. So there was this kind of humorous side to it that made it possible to do this send-up lyric, which was deliberately complex and a bit crazy, and to suggest, however unlikely it might have been, to suggest that the whole thing had been written by a, you know, precocious 11 or 12-year-old or whatever the Gerald Bostock figure was supposed to have been. But, I mean, really what I was saying in the whole thing is, you know, here's a little boy of very precocious nature writing sort of rather overblown stuff, and which is, I suppose, me in a way trying to cop out from being the author of it myself.
Really don't mind if you sit this one out. My words but a whisper, your deafness a shout. I may make you feel but I can't make you think. Your sperm's in the gutter, your love's in the sink. So you ride yourselves over the fields, and you make all your animal deals, and your wise men don't know how it feels to be thick as a brick. Sandcastle virtues are all swept away in the tidal destruction, the moral melee. The elastic retreat rings the close of play as the last wave uncovers the new-fangled way. But your new shoes are worn at the heels, and your suntan does rapidly peel, and your wise men don't know how it feels to be thick as a brick. So far away, I'm a bad dream that I just had today. And you shake your head, you said it's a shame. Spin me back down the years and the days of my youth. Draw the lace and black curtains and shut out the whole truth. Spin me down the long ages, let them sing the song.
I noticed that you're very careful never to refer to Thick as a Brick, the original, as a rock opera. Why not?
Well, it was a rock rambling, really. I mean, it was supposedly, I mean, the spoof, the parody aspect of the original Thick as a Brick was that it was supposedly written by an 8-year-old boy, who a wannabe poet, who who's having, I suppose, slightly beyond his years, rambling, pre-puberty kind of moment of, I don't know, just gushing forth with sort of grandiose ideas. And you know, it was a fun thing. This was the year of Monty Python. This was a year of the development of quite surreal British humour into an international phenomenon. So it was quite timely in the sense that this particular album should be a spoof, a parody, a setup, a complete fiction into which people quite readily bought, usually knowingly, but sometimes they didn't quite get the joke and took it all absolutely seriously. But for the most part, I think people understood it was a British humour thing. And my feeling from back then was that we were onto it was a timely event. It wouldn't have worked a year or two earlier, and it probably wouldn't have worked a year or two later, because by then we were into quite a major change of music culture in the UK, particularly as the so-called punk year or two started to come around. So at that particular point, this was not meant to be a rock opera. It was meant to be the ramblings of a young, precocious mind. And I never really thought about it as being in any way a parallel, perhaps, to something like Tommy, or even having the slightly mysterious Dark Side of the Moon kind of aura about it. That this was just whimsical, light-hearted fun. Although it had its serious moments embedded therein too. But no, never a rock opera. Just a bit of rambling, surreal British humour.
Still to come, we'll live in the past, bungle in the jungle, and then skate away. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Ian Anderson for Jethro Tull's 5450 Part 1.
Hi, welcome back to In the Studio. I'm Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull, and you're listening to me and Redbeard.
Jethro Tull's composer Ian Anderson admitted to me that many of the lyrical themes he explored on the prior albums, Aqualung and Thick as a Brick, were basic moral, religious, and social questions he had himself as an adolescent and a teenager. So I asked Anderson if his attitude had changed much as he matured.
No, I don't think it has, actually. I mean, if anything, probably reinforced, because it all comes back to you, you know. Much as a parent, you would like to avoid perpetuating the problems, you know, that you recall from your own childhood. I think it's inevitable that you do. And the important thing is just to realise that all these are changing phases, and that you just have to try and be understanding, mutually understanding, for that matter. So I don't think I've changed my mind about anything as far as sort of basic principles are concerned. I think you just try and keep in your mind that you've always got to try and be a little bit prepared to see the other person's point of view.
Happy and I'm smiling, walking miles to drink your water. You know I love to love you, and about you there's no other. We'll go walking out while others shout of war.
Living in the Past, one of three top 10 English singles by Jethro Tull in an 8-month period, inexplicably none of which appeared on the U.S. version of Benefit. But following 1972's remarkable number one seller, Thick as a Brick, all three British singles came out in the U.S. on the double album of singles, B-sides, and live performances as the album Living in the Past. There was a rather large technical gap between the creative potential of the recording studio back then and the live concert state of the art.
Back then, sound systems and staging and lighting and everything was very much in its infancy in terms of rock and roll concerts, so you would tend to have nights when things worked out okay and nights when it was, technically speaking, pretty disastrous. So it wasn't just us. I mean, it applied to other bands as well. I mean, I can remember when we were opening for Jimi Hendrix, you know, he was plagued by problems, you know, on consecutive nights. He'd have a totally different level of performance. I mean, he was, when he was good, he was fantastic. But when things went wrong for him technically, he was, it was dreadful, you know, and he knew it was dreadful and used to, you know, really lose heart. Same thing happened with Zeppelin when they were, when we were supporting them. You know, they would have nights when the PA system wasn't working properly or amplifiers would break down and they used to, you know, I mean, they went to pieces, you know. I think our approach was probably that, you know, you just couldn't afford to be upset by these things. You had to battle on. And but it was very up and down. I mean, we used to come off stage some nights feeling quite unhappy, you know, really, really tragically unhappy about the level of performance, which you just felt thwarted in because of technical problems. But that seems to be the most memorable aspect of all that period of time, was that you were fighting what seemed to be a, on average, losing battle with the very primitive technical side of the equation.
Walking through forests of palm tree apartments, scoff at the monkeys who live in their dark tents. Down by the water hole, drunk every Friday, eating their nuts, saving their raisins for Sunday. Lions and tigers who wait in the shadows, they're fast but they're lazy, and sleep in green meadows. Well, that's bungle in the jungle. Well, that's all right by me, yes. Well, I'm a tiger when I want love, but I'm a snake if we disagree. Just say a word and the boys will be right there with claws at your back to send the chill through the night. Hey, is it so frightening to have me at your shoulder? Thunder and lightning couldn't be bolder. I'll write on your tombstone, I thank you for dinner. This game that we animals play is the winner. Well, let's bungle in the jungle. Well, that's all right by me. Snakes in the grass. He's a lover of life, but a player of pawns. Yes, the king on his sunset lies waiting for dawn to light up his jungle as players resume. The monkeys see willing to strike up the tune. But let's bungle in the jungle.
Bungle in the Jungle from 1974's Jethro Tull album War Child, an album which successfully featured catchy, melodic, conventional length songs after Jethro Tull had repeated the sidelong epic length concept from Thick as a Brick on the critically panned A Passion Play album. Between 1968 and 1978, Jethro Tull was among the most popular bands in the world, and Ian Anderson thoughtfully examines that golden age for rock and roll.
I mean, you can never turn the clock back to that particular 5 or 6 years again. You know, I think it's a period that probably for a lot of people began with the creativity that suddenly came from nowhere with perhaps Sgt. Pepper or with the Pink Floyd's first album, Piper at the Gates of Dawn. And, I mean, from then on through, you know, some of the American bands like the Grateful Dead or the Doors or perhaps more importantly, Frank Zappa or Captain Beefheart in more, you know, creative terms, but paralleled in the UK with the early Pink Floyd and the sort of dying embers of the Beatles and some of the, I suppose even some of the Rolling Stones sort of better efforts like Beggar's Banquet, which was a good album from them of that period. But then with Hendrix and the Cream and the whole of that sort of English R&B that went off into its own kind of area of musical subculture, that whole creative period at the end of the 60s. I mean, you just can't ever have that again. So it's preposterous to talk about today's pop entrance as being the new Beatles or the new Kinks, respectively. You can't ever recreate that kind of excitement or that kind of sparkle that happened the first time around. Like a lot of people back then, I just assumed this was a kind of a short-lived phenomenon and rock music would evolve into something completely different. But I now believe that's not the case. I think we actually have absolute values in this genre which are not going to fundamentally change. There's not such a great stride being taken. You know, what happens is re-evaluation, repositioning a lot of the same ideas within a slightly different styling, a slightly different musical setting. But, you know, rock and roll, I think, is turning out to be a very finite music form. And I personally don't... I would be very surprised if... In 20 or 30 years from now, there are many fundamental changes in the way that we listen to and enjoy popular music. I think we have something that's probably going to be with us for a long, 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 long time to come.
Meanwhile, back in the year one, when you belonged to no one, you didn't stand a chance, son, if your pants were undone. 'Cause you were bred for humanity and sold to society. One day you'll wake up in the present day, a million generations removed from expectations of being who you really want to be. Skating away, skating away, skating away on the thin ice of the new day. So as you push off from the shore, won't you turn your head once more and make your peace with everyone? But those who choose to stay will live just one more day to do the things they should have done. And as you cross the wilderness, suspending in your emptiness, you really have to pray. Looking for a sign that the universal minds has written you into the passion play. Skating away, skating away, skating away on the thin ice of the new day. And as you cross the circle line, well, the eyes will greet behind. You're a rabbit on the run. And the silver splendors fly in the corner of your eye.
sun. Well, do you ever get the feeling that the story's too damn real and in the present tense? All and everybody's on the stage, and it seems like you're the only person sitting in the audience. Skating away, skating away, skating away on the thin ice of the new day.
Skating Away came from November 1974's War Child album, originally conceived as a Vietnam-era movie project that never got out of development. Nevertheless, it went to number 2 in America, number 14 in the UK. I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guest Ian Anderson, who returns at the same time next week. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2018, all rights reserved. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.